Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Catholic Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This channel and episode were created in collaboration with the American Catholic Historical Association, a conference of scholars, archivists, and teachers of Catholic studies. My name is Allison Isidore, and I'm a host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Barbara Maddock, a retired public historian who worked for the Bureau of Historic Preservations for the state of Florida. Barbara Maddock is the author of Teaching in Black and White, The Sisters of St. Joseph in the American South, published by Catholic University of America Press this coming January. Teaching in Black and White provides a rare glimpse into the personal and professional lives of women religious in Florida and Georgia from the mid-19th century to the early 20th century. The Sisters of St. Joseph, who are the focus of this book, to teach newly freed African Americans after the Civil War and remain there to this day. Maddock's book examines the sisters' contributions in shaping life in the South during Reconstruction as they established elite academies and free schools, creating orphanages and ministering to all during the yellow fever epidemics. Maddock's book examines the sisters' contributions in shaping the South during Reconstruction as they established elite academies and free schools, created orphanages, ministered to all during the severe yellow fever epidemics, and fought rising anti-Catholicism legislation that was sweeping across the rural region at this time. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Allison. Glad to be here.
Great. So before we dive into your book, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, I've lived most of my life in Florida. We moved here when I was about 7, then went through all of my secondary school and everything in Fort Lauderdale, where I grew up, and went to Emory University, where I majored in history. I thought I would be going into the sciences when I went. Is very much like now, there's a lot of emphasis on science and everything, but it only took me a quarter to find out that would not be a good choice for me. So eventually I ended up with history, which I realized my whole growing up had been a lot of history had been there, though not in a formal way. So from there, I finally came upon this, became aware of this new field of, I guess, what we call public history today. And Florida did, and it was just within years of that, Florida finally got a state museum, finally got a new archives and all of that. So anyway, to get into that, you basically needed a master's in history. And I decided, well, I'd go to a state school to do that, and thinking that I would go on to presidential libraries or something like that. So I came to FSU, majored in American history, got my master's in that. And I finished that. It was right in the middle of the 70s, much time as it is like now. It, ultimate inflation, and could not get a job. And but I finally did get my first permanent job with the state of Florida, working as in the state library. And I did that for about 8 years. And in the course of that, because state employees can get free tuition, and FSU is like 15-minute walk away, I did get a master's in library science. And after that, I went up to, literally went upstairs to transfer to the Division of Historical Resources. I was very glad to get back to my field of history, and ended up doing a lot of archaeological nominations. Of course, I knew nothing about archaeology. So I went to go take some courses in it and ended up with a master's in historical anthropology and the historical archaeology in that. And soon after that, almost immediately, this is over a course of many years, because working and it's only part-time. I really, really, really had a desire to get a PhD. So I did one more time. This is it. I worked back into pure history in the history of the South. And that's where I got my PhD in 2008. A lot of interesting things along the way. I met people in the historic preservation field, met a lot of people in over the time of working on National Register nominations. And that, so that gave me an intro into meeting some Sisters of St. Joseph, introduced by a colleague that we'd had working on nominations. And so that it all just flowed.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a great segue to my next question. How did you get into this project, right? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I was, of course, when you've been in school so long, you realize every paper needs to count toward whatever you're ultimately doing. So I my thesis for my master's degree in history had been on the 1841 yellow fever epidemic in Tallahassee. And so I'd learned a lot about yellow fever and that. And but I just didn't want to go back into that. And so I was looking around for a topic and nothing was coming together. So I said, well, I guess I'll just do yellow fever again. So I was going to do my dissertation on the yellow fever epidemic in 1888 in Jacksonville. And I was taking two seminars at that time. One was the social history one, and that was my paper was going to be that. I was also taking a seminar in women's history. I'd gotten a new major professor who was also primarily women's history professor, as well as the one for Florida. And she's the one who introduced me to women's history. This did not exist as a discipline in 72. I graduated from Emory in 72, and at that time, this didn't exist. But as a result of taking this at the same time I was taking this other seminar, I wanted a topic I could find related to yellow fever that was about women. And that's how I found out about the Sisters of St. Joseph, who had nursed in two epidemics, 1877 and then the big Jacksonville one in 1888. So as I worked on it, I found them ever so much more interesting than just yellow fever. So I changed my topic, and so I did a lot of my research then, thenceforth on that instead of yellow fever.
You're using also a lot of different sources for your research for this book, right? You're using a mix of newspapers and personal and government documents, and of course, some archive. What was the process of going through these documents? Did you have any challenges that you ran into doing this type of research?
Well, it's the first things you were mentioning, the government documents and newspapers and census records and all that. That's when the historians, they're just used to dealing with all of that kind of thing. And letters are also common. But in this case, letters from sisters to their superior. You do not see that. And when I heard about that they had these letters, I really was intrigued with that whole thing. They were like the crown jewels in the archives of there. They had them at the archives in St. Augustine. And I'd gone over for my first introducing myself to them, other than being just introduced. Well, some of them were in Tallahassee one time. And so I think after some evaluation, they decided that they could share these with me. And they had typescripts of about the originals. I don't know what actually happened to the actual papers, except for a few, but the others were in Le Puy, France, where the sisters had come from in their mother house. And that's the mother house where they were created as an order in 1650. So I did, this is sort of jumping around, but I did get to go to Le Puy and did get to see these letters, but they were, had been, what they would do is they would receive a letter from someone and then they would transcribe it. But it was the same person who did all, so the handwriting was all the same, but it was all the same, very small, very small. It was in French, of course. So that was one of the challenges, was translating these letters. And they're on page, you know, the 17 by 11 inch pages, tiny writing, and really challenged my limitations in French. But that was probably the most difficult part of it. The one part that was difficult with census records is that they're not given in their secular names. It's not like Mary Jones Robinson or something like that. It's sisters, I mean, Sister Mary. And then, so I would go through the microfilm, for example, because I don't know where they are in this big microfilm reel. And you sort of kind of go and you look, you see where it's just the same, very much the same as you quickly scan through it. And so, and then are trying to figure out how they have entered this. It's by their first name or by their last. They didn't use last names a lot of the time. So that was the other big challenge. And another thing challenging about this is that it took place over such a long period of time for this research to be done and then to be written. Because I was doing it as a part-time student, doing it and taking care of my elderly parents, or it's just lots of life just slows you down. But then to go back over 20 years, now where was that? Where did I find that? Or if, you know, it was a challenge.
Right. Yeah. I can only imagine. Before talking about the Sisters of St. Joseph, I wanted to talk about the Sisters of Mercy because they were in Florida prior to the arrival of the Sisters of St. Joseph. So what were the Sisters of Mercy doing in Florida? What was their role? And how did that change when the Sisters of St. Joseph arrived?
Well, the Sisters of Mercy, like the Sisters of St. Joseph, were invited to come to Florida by Bishop Vero. Now, and that was in 18, he arrived in 1858, and then he was basically having to organize this part of the world, which had really not had much Catholic attention since 1821, when the Americans took over. Under the Spanish, it was very Catholic. But then once the Americans took over the territory, what became the territory of Florida, they got the upper hand of governments and control. And the Catholicity remained, but it wasn't at the forefront. So they hadn't had bishops visiting them for a very long time. And then he came in 1858. He had been up in Maryland, where he taught in a seminary. He was a native of Le Puy, France. And as I said, he'd gone to Maryland where he was a teacher. And then he was appointed as a sort of a bishop. He was he then came to St. Augustine, and he saw the great need for help. And so he went to Providence, Rhode Island, to recruit Sisters of Mercy to go to St. Augustine, to come to St. Augustine where he was. And they established an academy for girls there, as was the custom. It was very well established. And that was in 1859 that they arrived. They came, and then there was also a group of brothers, Christian brothers, who came to teach boys. So they were there. And after the initial, probably the people weren't too sure about it because they were coming from the north. But anyway, it was very well received, very well respected. And then the Civil War started. And he, this very funny, this ought to be a movie of it. There was this funny episode where the bishop wanted to get them out of the way of harm's way, get them away from St. Augustine. And so he loaded up the Sisters of Mercy into a cart, and they started on this way. They wanted to go to Columbus, where it was going to be safe, because the Union Army is coming to get, or just to be there in St. Augustine. They never did anything destructive there. And it's really well told in another, it was too long a story, but it was just one misadventure after another. And it ended up getting them right into the middle of the battle. It was there in Columbus. I mean, an active battle at the time. After the war, they lived through all that. And after the war, about half came back to St. Augustine. And they resumed teaching at St. Mary's Academy. So, well, after the war, also then, Varreau was very concerned about the freed slaves. Even he had lived in Maryland, he'd lived in the United States, so he was very familiar with the culture and with slavery and how it was. And so then when he became this bishop down in Florida, he began, during the war, he had been known for he was one of the few bishops who spoke out in favor of slavery, but not in favor of the way they were being treated. And he's a long discourse about that. And one of the major things that he said, you know, that these are human beings, they have souls, you need to take care of them. You shouldn't be treating the women the way you are. And he had a lot to say about that. But as a result of all that, he was labeled as the rebel bishop. So there's another book. It's called The Rebel Bishop. And that's a good source for this story of how they went up to Georgia. So when they got back to St. Augustine, they resumed teaching there, but they had half as many members. And Varreau realized that there was too much to ask of them to also take on the teaching of the freed slaves. So he went back to Le Puy, which is where he grew up, and he recruited some Sisters of St. Joseph to come to teach the black slaves. And he was very eloquent in saying, there was a great need for this, and the Protestants have a jump on us. I mean, they started coming. They were there during the war itself. And so is saying these docile people, these unfortunate black people. And he really filled them with a love for the black people, even though they'd never seen black people before in Le Puy. Le Puy is in southern France, in the middle of the Grand Massif, this big plateau that's up above Lyon, basically. So it was a very isolated area. And so he went to recruit them, and about 60 volunteered, of whom they chose 8. And so these 8 arrived in September 1866, a little over a year after the war, and they came, and they, of course, this was all very, very foreign to them. It was the only thing familiar about it was St. Augustine has a European flavor to it because it still has its narrow streets, and so many of the colonial buildings are there. But the biggest problem they had is that they could not speak English. So, and that really was the main hindrance to them. Plus having to get used to French culture, the heat, mosquitoes, and they really couldn't understand why the white people were the way they were, and they really disdained the white people because of the way they treated the slaves, freed slaves.
Right. Yeah. And that kind of leads me, you know, into my next question about the teaching of these now freed slaves, right? These women at the heart of the book are not only teaching, you know, white students, but they're also teaching freed African-American students, right? You say that the French Sisters' missions was to protect the former slaves from the heretical teaching of Protestant missionaries. So who are the students that these sisters are now teaching, right? They're not just children, I assume, right?
Well, they mostly were teaching children, mm-hmm. but then at night, they started night schools for the adults. And at first, they, as I said, they were very hindered by their lack of English. And one of the big complaints and one of the big points in this competition they ended up in with the mostly it's missionaries of the American Missionary Association. And they came from New England, basically. Well, I mean, the sisters couldn't speak English. The AMA Protestants could. So they could jump into teaching reading, writing, arithmetic, geography, and regular basic teachings. Because, see, you hadn't been able to educate slaves. That was against the law during the war, before the Civil War ended. But they were allowed to teach religion. So during the war and before. So when they came, it was religion was something that they needed to address, because the sisters were trying to keep the Catholic freedmen, keep them Catholic. And it was by far, St. Augustine was like a Catholic enclave in the South. There were not many Catholics in the South, but they were very strong there. The Protestants were teaching religion also. And of course you had the Protestants thought these Papists were heretics, and the sisters thought that the Protestants were heretics. So you had the Papists and the heretics. And you see in the letters, it's in the letters where you actually can see when they mention it, when they mention each other, that comes up just about every time. And the sisters bemoan the fact that they had like 150 students, whereas the Protestants had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students. And they were teaching, they were heavily teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic, Bible teaching as well. So you had, there also was this divergence in, the sisters were teaching piety at first because they couldn't talk about other stuff yet because of the English problem. And they would, you could see this in the rewards. They would give holy cards and medals and that kind of thing as rewards. AMA, American Missionary Association, they would give Bibles as their rewards. And many went to them because the main thing they wanted to learn was how to read, because they wanted to vote. They wanted to be able to write. This was as it was in the early years. As the sisters learned English, then they started the academics. And as more, they got new members, postulants, groups from America, they had more people helping them. That's another thing. The Sisters of Mercy really helped them in these early years with the English, and also introducing them to the Black community that was there. So eventually it was equal. And the education, once it they were able, it was equal, whether it was the freed slaves or the poor whites, they usually were just taught the same way. And they had the same sorts of closing exercises at the end of a school year and the competitions, you know, essays and singing and recitals and that kind of thing. And they, when they had a contest kind of thing between who's going to get the prize for this or that, they did as well, if not better, than the public schools sometimes. With the Protestants, there was a letter that explained how they would help them also, you know, paying their bills and showing them how to do that and visiting in their homes. And so it was very much, it's the same, but different to me. I mean, their intent was the same. They both wanted to save the blacks, as they referred to them. And that's how they referred to in the French. It's mm-hmm. You'd say the same thing. So that's how the teaching was. And then it ended up, basically, I think they were so confounded, very confounded by the Black religion. And because without the constraints, the African-Americans now were able to start their own churches. And many of them, some of the Catholics too, switched over to this because they could be the pastors and the leaders, and they could worship the way they wanted to worship. And they were just, they couldn't believe the way that they worshiped. I mean, their style was so different. And I kind of imagine it's like, here they are at each other, the Protestants and the Catholics. And then meanwhile, the Blacks are just going out the back door and starting their own denominations. So.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The part of your book I found so fascinating was this rivalry between the sisters and the Protestant American Missionary Association, the AMA, as you said. We should probably talk about these sisters since they are the focus of your book, right? What else can you tell us about the sisters who came over, right? We know their names, but, you know, what can you tell us about them?
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to achieve, was to be able to try to portray them as women, as people. They had feelings. They had disappointments. They had things that were funny. You get their personalities somewhat through their letters. Of the eight, three of them were, you'd say, mature, seasoned sisters. Mother Sidoni was 40 when she came. And then Sister Julie Lucelle was 36. And Josephine Deliage was in her 30s also. Other than that, the five others with them were all brand new novices in their 20s. And when they, I think that mix was good. You had the stability and the wisdom of the older ones, but you had the exuberance and ready to go for whatever, you know, with the younger ones. And one of the ones, Sister Julie, she was funny. And she had a very dry sense of humor, And she talked about one time on the ship coming over. It's a 3-week voyage. And they had debated, they'd been hearing about all this Catholicism that was going on in America in the 1850s, just 10 years before the burning down of the convent in Charlestown in Massachusetts. And so they debated whether they should wear their habits or not. And they decided they would. So they're wearing their habits, and they found that they were seen as curiosities by these Protestants who maybe had never seen a nun before. I have to realize that then in the South, or actually, unless you're from the North, you hadn't really even seen a nun. But they were respected. They were deferred to. They weren't harassed or anything like that. And they would have their meals on the ship. Then there was a dining area. And so they would sit at table. And Sister Julie said, we had to always stifle our laughter. Because, I mean, they would want to talk. And it was, but see, these Americans, they're so somber. And see, I don't know if they can laugh. And they said, and it would be, they would have no difficulty with silence because it wouldn't be anything missing for them. And then there were other things, but that was her personality. She was the one that mostly worked in Mandarin, which is a little community south of Jacksonville, near Jacksonville. So that's north of Jacksonville is north of St. Augustine. And then Sister Josephine was just, she was more just drier. Just, she wasn't funny really, but she would say what she thought about things. So then the more adventuresome ones, when they heard about the yellow fever epidemic, it was when they're on their retreat and the bishop came and said they need people to nurse. And some of them had this in 1877, I was in Fernandina, which is north of Jacksonville. And they were on a retreat, and some of them, they had a house there. A few of them were there. So they went back, and most of the town was deserted. Most people had evacuated. But usually the case was that poor people and the Black people couldn't do that, couldn't afford that. So they were there, though, and they tended to the sick. They buried, knew how to take care of people for burial stuff, and two of them died in it. But they were, it was almost like they were anticipating going, because in one letter there's this discussion with another sister about how if we're missionaries, we're supposed to be suffering. They were just looking for their chances to suffer, and so they did experience that. And actually, they did not really know each other until they came out there, because there are little places in the valleys and the crags and in the mountains there near Le Puy. And so they had not been, they were sisters of St. Joseph or the novices. They were probably at the mother house when they were novices. But generally, the older ones probably didn't know each other because they're different places.
You hinted on it a little bit there at the start, this, you know, anxiety or fear potentially of the anti-Catholicism that's going on in the U.S. at this time or 10 years prior to their arrival, right? And I wanted to talk about that anti-Catholicism that these women did face. You said they were not harassed, but as you explained, there was a great amount of anti-Catholicism legislation in Florida, or legislators that were in Florida during the 1910s. So what were these women dealing with?
Well, anti-Catholicism had been in America from the colonial period. And Catholics were outlawed. Catholic, they couldn't hold office. They didn't have religious freedom. But with the end of the American Revolution, they did gain this religious freedom. And at first, there were so few Catholics in the South that anti-Catholicism wasn't really even a thing for them. And but by the 1910s, there was a rise of anti-Catholicism, partially fueled, or largely fueled, I'd say, by anti-Catholic writers who put forth periodicals that were anti-Catholic. And it was at the time when there was change in the South, in the United States, with progressivism, the rise of industrial cars being invented. It was just a change, social change going on. And then people who were alarmed at that, again, it's similar to what we're going through today, started publishing these anti-Catholic things. And the two that were most important were Tom Watson, who was a Georgia legislator, and he published the Jeffersonian Magazine. And then another one is called The Menace, and it was by Phelps, who was a publisher. And that went across the country, but in the South, it was taken up a lot by the small towns and the businesses and all who were concerned about all these changes going on. So then it did affect Florida politics. A lot of the 1916 election for governor focused a lot on anti-Catholicism, which led to all these, the other things of the legislation, the legislators. Some, you know, the legislative process is a very strange thing. It can be, if it's done, if the way it is in your civics books, you hear a bill, everybody knows, it's all clear, everybody understands what it's about, and then you vote on it, and that's the result of that. But bills will go, and then some of them never get read before they're voted on. And for instance, there was an anti-garb bill. Isn't 1913 was the year when they had the most anti-Catholic legislation, and an anti-garb bill that it said that you could not teach in public schools, or you couldn't teach, basically. You had to remove all your insignia, like you couldn't wear a cross. You couldn't wear, others point out, well, those who opposed this bill said, well, that would put, you know, Epworth Methodists, like women couldn't wear their Epworth pins or the other Christian organizations. But that bill was called the Anti-Garb Bill. And it was thought, well, the legislators just voted on it without really reading it. They thought it had something to do with garbage control. So it's a tricky thing to get good legislation. But some of these passed, some of them didn't. Typical other ones where they had reading the Bible, but it had to be the King James version. Couldn't be a Catholic Bible and be King James. It also affected the gubernatorial race in 1916. There was a man called Sidney J. Katz, and he had been a pastor, his Baptist pastor, an insurance agent in Florida, and he ran for governor, and he ran on an anti-Catholic platform. But he was elected. Turned out he was a pretty good governor. And all he claimed all of that was just all politics. Now he's not anti-Catholic and all that. So also then, aside from the election, at the same time, then there's a big splash all over the newspapers, even in Europe, that three nuns had been arrested in St. Augustine. And this was because one of the bills that the legislature passed was saying that it was illegal for whites to teach whites in black schools and blacks to teach. It was a very confusingly written bill. Anyway, they were arrested. Three of the nuns were arrested. The mother superior and two sisters who taught in the schools. And in the book, there's a picture of that class. And they're in that picture. They were white, and they were teaching blacks in a black school. So it went to court, and after much wringing of hands and waiting, that the decision finally came down. Well, that only applies to public schools. It does not apply to private schools. So the very thing they'd come from France to do, they were still allowed to do after that. And the bishop at that time was Curley, Michael Curley, and he was very young, he was very modern, he wasn't going to stand for this anti-Catholicism. And so the point that I try to make in the book is I believe that the whole thing was a setup to get the sisters arrested so it would go to court, so it would get a final decision, because it was clear that that shouldn't be. So that was the big event of the anti-Catholicism. And then over the years, then anytime there were these big crises like the yellow fever epidemics, and then the teaching of the schools was so beneficial, that all served to help quell any anti-Catholicism and to join the Protestants and the Catholics together. In St. Augustine, one of the sisters was known as the Angel of Jacksonville, for the Jacksonville yellow fever epidemic work and the other work she did in Jacksonville before that.
All it was such a fascinating book to read, and especially that case too. So Barbara, I'm curious, do you think that the sisters succeeded in what they set out to do in Florida?
Mother Helene was saying, I don't understand how we have any students. And so they had about 150, where they have these huge schools and they have all these teachers and they have all these books and they're supported by the government. And they, you know, basically, and sometimes their parents are paid to send their students to the classes. So I think when it came down to it, I think Varro, maybe, I don't know if he would have considered them, the sisters that he brought over, as a successful thing. But I'd say yes, they did, because they did. They kept the Catholics Catholic for the most part. And then they did all these other things that established Catholicism much on a much stronger Florida and Georgia. But Florida is what I mostly talk about. So I'd say yes, they were, because they're still here and they're still doing what they're supposed to do.
I see we're running out of time here. I have one more question for you, and that's, what projects are you currently working on? Are there any lingering questions that you have from writing, teaching in black and white, or are you going in a new direction, right? You're retired now. Are you still writing, or are you going to now relax?
Well, I'm thinking I'd like to look into the history of the Episcopal orders, because they're not very well known even among Episcopalians and Catholics. I mean, very rarely know that there are Episcopal nuns. There's one in particular, the Sisters of St. Mary, the Community of St. Mary is the oldest one. So I'd like to look into the history, their history, and perhaps others.
Well, that all sounds really fascinating. And if you write a book about it, I can't wait to read it.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Barbara, for joining us.
Thank you. I hope you have some wonderful more books to review. That'll be good.
Well, this has been New Books in Catholic Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.